This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Hear about a community-wide effort to put kids in beds. Many simply sleep on the floor.
Every day starts with a great night's sleep. And if you're sharing a bed or if you're on a cold or uncomfortable floor, it's difficult to get your day started on the right foot.
That's Ryan Heron. He and Robert Bosquez are organizing the second annual West Bloomington Revitalization Project Tool Library Bed Blitz. Teams will build 80 beds this year. At the end of next month, a longtime hobby store in downtown Bloomington will close. GLT's Ryan Denham stops by Hobbyland. And after a 50% drop in donations last year, the United Way of McLean County is changing its fundraising model. Charlie Schlenker talks with CEO David Taylor. All of that and a GLT News update on the way. It's September 21st, 2017. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. A good day starts with a good night's sleep, and most people sleep in a bed, but not everyone can afford one, and that's especially hard for families who have children who are sleeping on the floor, on furniture, or with other family members because they don't have a bed of their own. Helping to meet that need is the West Bloomington Revitalization Project's Bed Blitz. On October 14th, three shifts of four-person teams will build beds for 5 to 18-year-olds at Youth Build. And while the building takes place in October, the deadline to apply for a bed is today. Robert Bosquez and Ryan Heron are on the WBRP board and direct the tool library, and they're helping to organize the bed blitz. Bosquez says the idea came from the Build a Bed program at Morehead State University in Kentucky.
So we reached out with Recycle Furniture for Families and just asked them what their need was, and they said their number one need was beds. And we came up with a plan that we borrowed and we ran with it.
And Robert or Ryan, did either of you have any clue as to the need in this community for kids who don't have beds? I mean, most people would think a kid sleeps on a bed.
Right. You would think that, but and kind of as we heard about this and started talking with some of our members that come into the tool library, talking with other organizations, they kind of echoed this sentiment. And even then, I think we still struggled to believe that until last year we sent out our applications, not really sure what to expect. And we had over 106 applicants in that first year. And that's what really solidified that this was a need in the community for us.
106 applicants, but you only built 40 beds.
That's correct. Yeah, we didn't know what to plan for last year. So we set 40 at the max, and we hit that right away.
So what would a basic bed frame, mattress, and bedding for a child cost a family, typically?
Yeah, I mean, a bed frame, a mattress, sheets, pillows. If you don't have all those things, you're in $200, $300, possibly $400, depending on where you get that stuff from.
And that's a significant portion of some of these families' monthly income.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, especially if you're in a situation where you're moving into a new apartment or a new home and you're paying first and last month's rent plus all the utilities and getting those set up and all those moving expenses come in. And if you have 2, 3, 4 beds, that's a very significant investment for a family to make.
Sure. It's important to remember that's just $400 for one child.
For one child.
Robert, what did you learn in the first year that you're problems or things that you think could go better in the second year?
Actually, to be honest, we had no idea what we were going to do, what we were doing when we first started doing this. And at the end of the day, me and Ryan looked at each other and we said, things went perfect. I mean, they went smooth. Volunteers, there was only one group that did not show, but we had another group step up and build these beds. And really, I mean, the whole day went smooth. The other thing that we did, of course, find out that we need to do is raise more money, because 40 beds was not enough. It was not enough. So we, our goal right away was to let's just double it. And that was our goal, to double it. And we said, we'll somehow come up with the money.
So what kind of fundraising efforts have you done for the Bed Blitz?
We were fortunate enough to be on the Burns-O-Matic Find Your Fire grant last year. We submitted the grant in, which was fairly simple. All we had to do is just give them the idea or our idea on how to use a blowtorch. And we were one of the top 10 finalists out of the whole United States. And then from December 1st through December 31st of last year, it was all voting, online voting. And we were fortunate enough to come in second, and that was $7,500. So that pretty much solidified us that we were going to do 80 beds.
So no individual contributions? Did the teams that helped build the beds actually make a contribution?
Last year we did that, but through the various fundraising efforts, after we did this last year and the word kind of spread and got out, we had a number of organizations really step up to the plate and seeing how they can help us achieve our goal this year. So beyond the Burns-O-Matic grant, which we really ran through last winter, we also had the Daybreak Rotary Club stepped up to sponsor the bunky boards, kind of the
box springs.
That's correct, yeah. As well as we had Tempur-Pedic mattresses through a partnership with Sherman's, who supplied the box springs and mattresses last year at a significant discount. They stepped up to the plate and were able to provide us all 80 mattresses this year through a program that Tempur-Pedic runs.
So everything went well the first year, Robert. No changes in the second year. What about childcare?
Oh, that is true. So this year we are having child care provided that day. So if there's a family out there that has, you know, little ones and they want to volunteer, this can, you know, they'll be able to bring them and feel comfortable leaving them there with someone, and they're going to have activities set up for the kids there.
So tell me how all of this works. Let's start with families who need beds. How are you getting the word out to them, and how do they apply, Ryan?
Yeah, we started our application process earlier in the month. We reached out to a number of social service organizations that we've had partnerships or contact with, as well as the local school districts, and requested that they provide the application to their families that they service or may benefit from the program, as well as through social media and other channels. We got that word out, and so September 21st at 7 p.m., all of our applications will be due for this year, and we will go through and get in contact with those families that are able to receive a bed this year.
What does an unsuccessful application look like? What keeps someone from not moving forward?
Yeah, we give high priority to children that currently do not have a bed. So if a family is looking just to replace existing beds, we'll give priority to those families that may be on an air mattress, a couch, or we've seen families of four or five all sharing one singular bed. So we'll give priority to those families, as well as we'll look at income requirements. And so giving priority to those lower middle income families.
And what about sleeping on somebody else's bed or sleeping on a couch? How does that all fit into sort of evaluating these applications, Robert?
Sure. So as Ryan said, you know, priority, of course, is going to be with little ones sleeping on the floor, air mattress. And once you reach a certain number, so for example, say we have 30 of those applicants and the rest of them, then we go, okay, the next one is, are they sharing a bed? Are they sleeping on a couch? Are the parents giving up their bed for their kids? So that's the process we kind of go through and get all these beds and make sure they're going to the right families.
And you said, before we started talking today, you said you already had 30 or so applications, which doesn't sound like a lot. You had 106 last year, but they all sort of come in at the last minute.
Yes, correct. So last year, the last day that they were due, we received just a stack full of applications. So I would say 50% of those we received the last day.
So any idea what you might get this year? Have you done a better job of getting the word out? Do you think you'll have more than 106 applications?
We think that we'll get within 80 to 100 applications this year is what our assumption. We were able to fulfill 40 of those requests last year that we had, as well as provide information on other services in the community where, like Recycling Furniture for Families, has programs that are ongoing. So we assume we'll get to that number, but we won't know until the 21st.
So there's churn in the community. People move in, people move out. But I suppose one measure of success for this program is to see the level of need actually go down. You start off at 40 beds, you may give away 80 this year, but if next year you're at 40, it doesn't mean you're any less successful, does it?
No, I think that's our ultimate goal, is we'll continue doing this program annually until we stop getting applications. When that happens, we'll consider this a success and move on to the next event.
And what about the actual bed building? I wouldn't know where to start if I were building a bed. So how does a team know what they're going to do, Robert?
Sure. So we're going to do youth build. Students are pre-cutting all our wood, all the lumber, and we're going to have them set up into kits. And really, you don't need any experience at all. The kits will be set up before every shift. Myself and Ryan will do a little demonstration, a quick 5-minute demonstration, just to let them know this is what you have.
So the kit is all the wood, all the lumber, the tools you need, all of that.
Everything. Everything will be at the table.
Tell me about Youth Build, that program, and what they do in the community.
Youth Build, this is a great program. What they do as far as for us is they, first of all, give us the location. Without this big location, we won't have a place to build these beds. So they stepped up to the plate last year, and Tracy Polson, the director there, is in our committee, and she's been great. And again, she's offered her place, and that's where we're going to do it again this year.
Yeah, and along with providing that space, Youth Build really helps us get prepared for the event in allowing all, you can imagine, 80 mattresses takes up a lot of space. So they provide that warehouse space to store mattresses, lumber. They pre-cut, pre-sand the lumber, and provide the child care the day of the event, as well as just act as an amazing host and partner in making this a reality every year.
How long does it take to build a bed, Robert?
So our shifts are currently set up for 2 hours, but that gives us enough space to set up and tear down after the build. So we're looking at about an hour and a half.
And is there a headboard, a footboard? I mean, is this just a sort of a platform?
Yeah, there's four basic parts. There's the headboard, the footboard, and then the two side rails. So that's that, and then the slats that go underneath the support.
And then what? You said the stuff was pre-sanded. Is it left as raw wood?
It is. So we pre-sand, and then after a group is done building, they'll go to one of our sanding stations and give everything a nice fine finish, removing any imperfections on the wood to make it safe for a family to have. The families take the beds home that day, so they are raw wood, but we will provide information as being part of the tool library for families to become members, and they can come in. We have over 1,000 paintbrushes that are available.
Do the teams get to meet the families?
We will have some of the families. We do invite them to help build the day of the event, as well as we ask that they come and pick up the day of the event. So there is the opportunity to interact within the community. We really see this as a community building event. So we want to invite volunteers, families together for one day to help solve a need in our community and do something great for your neighbor.
So 4-person teams. You have a morning shift and an afternoon shift. How many more teams or people do you need?
So currently right now, our morning shift is filling up pretty quick. But the afternoon shift, there's still a lot of openings. So we're looking for, from noon to 5. There's two shifts there. So there's 12 to 2 and then 2 to 4. So those shifts are the ones we're looking to for volunteers.
How many more people or teams do you think you need?
We would need about 100 more individuals to meet our need.
We're 25 teams.
Yep.
Right.
And you mentioned the mattresses and the box springs. What else does it take to complete this? You have the quilts coming from Nancy Stone and her group, and we'll hear from her in just a moment here on Sound Ideas. What else? What about pillows, pillowcases, that stuff?
Yes, we got pillows, pillowcases, twin sheets. We also teamed up with Build-A-Bear out of Peoria, and they were able to provide 80 bears this year that will also be part of the package.
And Ryan, you alluded to this, but what do you think this initiative says about Bloomington Normal? Sort of coming together to meet a need, everyone pulling together in the same direction. What do you think?
We've got an amazing community here that's always looking for ways that they can step up and make a difference, fulfill a need. And this is just another one of those opportunities that I think people love to do. It's a great event to get to know your neighbors and to do something great.
And you both have seen this in action. Robert, what do you think about this event?
Of course. Let's make no mistake about this. Bloomington Normal is a great community, hands down community. the good thing about, the great thing that I love about Bloomington Normal, is, as Ryan alluded to, is when there's a need, they step up. So, for example, you know, when we heard about that kids needed beds and we put this out there, we got an overwhelming response. We see families bring their kids as well and help volunteer. So these, you know, they're passing it down as, let's help thy neighbor. And Bloomington Normal, again, awesome community.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the great things about what we do, you know, we've got the tools, but we didn't have the volunteers. We didn't have the manpower to do this. And so that came together. We didn't. And one of the great things was some of the families that came in to help build, that we saw them become members of the tool library. And I remember the weekend after the bed blitz last year, we had a family come in to become members and to check out tools because the parents wanted to build a bed of their own, right? So it was great just to see this, what's really one day's effort can really expand and balloon into something so much more.
What impact can this have on a child's life if everyone's had a poor night's sleep and then tried to move through their day the next day sort of in a fog? If you're sleeping on the floor or in bed with somebody else or on an uncomfortable couch, how does that impact that child's life and how does the bed change it?
Every day starts with a great night's sleep, right? And if you're sharing a bed or if you're on a cold or uncomfortable floor, it's difficult to get your day started on the right foot. And that translates into school, into performance. One of the things also that a bed provides is a private space of your own for a child. So a place to do homework, to cozy up and read a book, just to kind of get away from it all and to reset. It really provides that own personal private space.
So Robert, do you think it's life-changing for these families or these children?
Oh, absolutely. So I work in the education, and I've talked to teachers and just kind of get an idea about, you know, how can we help? What do you guys see throughout a day as a kid either is struggling or having a hard time? And they say their number one thing is they didn't get a good night's rest, you know, and who knows what that good night rest, you know, looks like. But as Ryan said, if they have their own space, their own bed where they can just go and just lay down for either 5 minutes and just, you know, just focus on themselves and not have to share anything or just be worried about anything, that goes a long way. Kids get a good night rest, then they're fresh, ready to go in the morning, and that, you know, that leads to changes in the classroom, and it means paying more attention and just having a better attitude all over.
Ryan and Robert, thanks for coming in to talk about the bed blitz on Sound Ideas.
Well, thank you.
Ryan Heron and Robert Bosquez are on the West Bloomington Revitalization Project Board, and with the Tool Library, they're helping to organize the WBRP's Bed Blitz on October 14th. Today is the deadline to apply for a bed, but Heron says as of last night, they've received more than 80 applications for 80 beds. Volunteers are still needed, however. Teams can sign up for a 90-minute shift to build a bed. The web address is thetoollib.com. This is Sound Ideas on 89.1 FM, GLT, and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.
Support for GLT comes from Martin's Home Furniture, featuring FlexSteel brand sofas, love seats, sectionals, and recliners, both leather and upholstery, built to be comfortable and built to last. Complimentary local delivery always available at Martin's Home Furniture in Bloomington. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. One of Bloomington's most iconic stores will be closing next month. Hobbyland has been a Main Street mainstay for 63 years, most recently on the north end of downtown Bloomington. For local hobbyists, it's been the go-to store for model trains, RC cars, and model rockets. GLT's Ryan Denham visited the store and its owner as the end of the line draws near.
That's the sound of the most famous red door in Bloomington Normal. A fun store with the red door has been Hobbyland's slogan for years. Hobbyland owner Jerry Martin didn't come up with the catchphrase, but he certainly popularized it with local radio ads and other promotion since he took over in 2005, the last time Hobbyland needed to be saved. That red door will close for the last time October 28th, when Martin shuts down the store and retires. Martin says he tried for months to find a buyer, a Jerry Martin for the next decade or two, but no one stepped up like he did 12 years ago.
We've had things on Facebook, and I've had it emailed out there to customers. Some of my regular customers, it's kind of a word of mouth kind of thing. So, they spread it around, but we just haven't had anybody that's had any interest in it at all.
So tell me about the circumstances back in 2005 when you eventually rescued this place.
Okay, in 2005, this place was basically a disaster. It was more of a junk store than it was a hobby store. By that time, the third owner had gotten a hold of it, and the guy didn't really care about his customers. In fact, to this day, I still can't figure out what he was doing in here, because he didn't have you as a customer, interest in you as a customer. And he was just kind of letting it go. So he only had it for about 2.5 years. And then it was just basically going out of business when I bought it in 05. And I really feel if I wouldn't have stepped in and rescued the store, it by early 2006, it would have been gone.
What are some things that you tried to do to inject some new life into the place and keep it going?
Basically tried to clean up all the old inventory. There was inventory in here from probably 20 years ago at that point in time. So we marked everything down at half price and tried to get it out, and then just basically started from front to back on the store and cleaned it up, painted it, put new flooring in. And we've done improvements to the building over the last 12 years that have really enhanced the the attractiveness of the building and the business.
Has Hobbyland been in this physical location since 1954?
No, it started down the street at 1110, where the old Walgreens used to be. There's that Family Dollar tree down there now. That's where it started, and then it moved to this location in 1969.
Are you the one that came up with the fun store with the red door?
Actually, it was the original owner, Merle Murray, but he never really marketed. He had a static sign on the building. And the letters and the words were so small, it was really, really hard to read. And so when I took over in 05, I wanted to market the store with that slogan, Fun Store with a Red Door. So I made that part of my naming of the store. And so everything that we do, business cards, brochures, everything has Fun Store with a Red Door on it. So that's how people recognize the store now.
People have a pretty emotional connection to this store. I just know from talking to our newsroom the other day when I mentioned we'd be doing a story about this, and I said you had announced your closing, there was a lot of, when I did that. I wonder if you can just talk about your customer base and how they think of this store and their connection to it.
I have a lot of good, loyal customers that come in here, both electric train customers as well as RC customers. And so, they're very saddened by it because, it's hard to find any, hobby store, let alone a full-line hobby store, where you can just walk in and pick up the part you're looking for and put it in your hands and look at it. And that's what most people like about the store, especially our paint department. And we have a tremendous amount of hobby paints that you just can't find anywhere else. And people love that because they just can come in, like I said, and just whatever they want, they just come in, pick it up, and out the door they go. So that's where we're really going to see people saddened by the store leaving, is the fact that they just can't come in here and just buy that one little item. They're going to have to buy it online.
For folks who haven't been in the store recently, what is your bread and butter these days? Is it on the train side, RC side? What is kind of your sweet spot?
Well, the trains are basically seasonal. That season really doesn't start until late October. So that train season runs from like late October through April. And then once the weather gets nice after the winter season, people don't want to stay in their house anymore and down the basement operate trains. They want to get outside. So the other side of the store is our RC. So we do helicopters, quadcopters, RC cars, boats, kites, rocketry. So it's kind of a split between the two depending on what season it is. But there are some things in here that sell all year round, like rocketry. That will sell 12 months out of the year. Plastic model kits, that will sell 12 months out of the year. But other things are kind of seasonal, like the trains.
Well, I wonder if you could talk at all about what the internet has done to a hobby store like this over the last several years.
Huge challenge, and it's really hurt small mom and pop hobby stores, especially because people just go online and find something that's maybe just a dollar or two cheaper, and they get free shipping, and that makes their decision up for them right away. And that's just been a killer to small mom-and-pop stores, especially the hobby industry.
How have you stayed open this long?
Just, again, loyal customers. And we've lost a lot of loyal customers. And that's another thing that's figured into this whole thing. When you figure, you know, a lot of my customers, older customers, have passed away. We have some customers that have moved away completely out of Illinois for obvious reasons. And we have other customers that have changed hobbies or gotten out of the hobby completely. The closing of the Mitsubishi plant was huge loss for me in here, because we had several customers that did trains and then other customers did RC. So I had a nice group of Mitsubishi employees that came in here and, you know, they had the money to spend. So that whole thing, if you put that in the whole equation and then throw in the internet sales on top of it, it makes it very challenging.
Well, you mentioned that some of your loyal customers had passed away over the years. They're older customers. What have you observed about, you know, kids these days? Do you think that they're still into trains and RCs like kids were maybe 30, 40 years ago?
No, I don't believe they are, but I think, you know, parents have brought their young kids in here, I think, just trying to introduce them to it, just to see their reaction, to see what they think about it. But it really is hard now for younger kids because they're on their phone all the time, you know? And, I mean, they're just not interested in coming in and buying a plastic model kit where, you know, you put the model together and, I mean, you read directions, follow instructions, and you build something and you can say, hey, I did that. There's just not that much interest in it like it used to be.
If I can ask you, Jerry, what are you going to miss most about running this store?
Oh, I just think the customers that come in here, I mean, we've really developed a real good close relationship with a lot of people. And, you know, I'm going to miss those people. You know, it's a good conversation. And, you know, we talk a lot about different things, you know, just the hobby in general, electric trains, RC cars. So that's what I'm going to miss the most, I think, is my customer base.
What's going to be next for you? You're going to be retired. What are your plans?
I'm going to retire and hopefully spend more time with my grandkids. They're down in Nashville. And so I really don't get to see them that much. And then I have other family responsibilities in Decatur I have to take care of. So I've got a lot on my plate.
Are you still? Do you have any feelers out there right now with any potential buyers? Or has it been any nibbles that are worth mentioning?
No, I haven't had anyone come in and expressed any type of interest at this point in time. But I own the building, so what I'm going to do is clean it out and then just try to lease the building, you know, since I own the property. And it is a nice building, and I've taken real good care of it, so I really feel confident that I can lease it.
GLT's Ryan Denham with Hobbyland owner Jerry Martin. The store first opened in 1954 as a toy store called Murray's Hobbyland. It's been a mainstay in the 600 block of North Main Street since 1969. Closing day at Hobbyland is October 28th. You're listening to Sound Ideas on GLT.
Sometimes on Ask Me Another, our contestants are wrong.
That is incorrect.
Are you kidding me?
Other times, they're so wrong, they're right.
Skorts Illustrated.
Skorts Illustrated is funny.
It's amazing.
That should have been the answer.
Join me, Ophira Eisenberg, on NPR's Hour of Puzzles, Word Games, and Trivia. Ask Me Another, Saturday morning at 10 on GLT, News and Ideas.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, reminding families that September is Life Insurance Awareness Month. You can take simple steps today to protect what matters most, from your family to your business. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Last year, the United Way of McLean County had a big drop in donations, attracting contributions of $1.8 million. That was down from $3.5 million the previous year. Several things influenced that result and the $1.3 million drop in distributions to programs. State Farm Insurance stopped running a traditional campaign in favor of a web-driven menu of options for employee donations and matching. CEO David Taylor told GLT last spring that millennials are different in giving than prior generations, in that they give to causes they believe in with less regard to geography, sometimes nationwide instead of to community needs. Taylor joins GLT's Charlie Schlenker to explore how the United Way is adapting to this new reality with a year-round campaign and with different approaches in asking for help for the human service agencies in the community. Taylor says last spring they gave member agencies a chance to rework allocations based on where they thought the more limited dollars would do the most good.
one of the, I guess, items of feedback from agencies was flexibility. How can you be flexible to help us make the most impact in the community? And so from that, we allowed them, if they had more than one program with us, even if they were across different focus areas. So for example, education, income, health, and community strengthening are our four focus areas. If you had an agency that had a program in health and one in community strengthening, but they felt the health program was really one of the more important ones that they do and needed that money from community strengthening, the program that they had there, to go towards the health program, we allowed for that flexibility. And so at the end of the day, then we had a handful of agencies that declined the funding overall. They just didn't feel like they necessarily needed it. And so we went from 64 programs.
Wait, they said, yeah, we're okay?
Yeah.
You should put that money somewhere else?
Yeah, and I don't know
who did that? What agency does that?
So the regional alternative school, they had actually decided that, you know, their programs were self-sustaining and they didn't necessarily need that money from United Way anymore because the programs that we had supported, one was a credit recovery program. I can't think of the other one right off the top of my head, Charlie, but they determined, you know what, we're in good shape with these. Let that money be kind of redistributed among
for the greater
left.
For the greater
yep.
good.
And Chestnut Health Systems is another one that did the same.
Okay. So that allowed you to give a little bit of extra money to some other places. Who got the money and which other agencies said, let's put all of our nickels on this program versus that program?
Yeah, and that's a great question. You know, so in the past 2 years, we've had 64 programs and 32 agencies. We're down now to about 48 programs and 29 agencies. So we definitely had some movement among different agencies and their programs as far as what they were funding. A great example would be the Center for Human Services. So they had three different programs that were based around mental health issues, needs in the community. And Tom Barr and his group at the Center for Human Services really decided that their one program, the medical services, was the most important one of the three. So they had one that was with transitional housing, and I forget the third one right off the top of my head.
A mental health thing? Or?
Yeah, they were all related to mental health, but they just felt like that realistically the most important and critical service that they provided among the programs. And not to say that those other two weren't critical in their minds, but at the end of the day, given the amount of money that was available, they felt it was most important to put all of that money into those mental health services for those that were most in need.
So with this two and a half year consolidation process, shrinkage process, how does the current allocation meet the United Way strategic vision as laid out in its community assessment of needs? Does that need to be reworked, and where are you in that reprioritization process that occurs every so often anyway?
Yeah, and I think that we were already kind of there, Charlie. It's just that with the amount of money that was available, we were trying to make the most impact and giving the agencies a voice in what would create that greatest impact in the community. And so a number of the programs that we already have are dealing with issues that were pointed out in that needs assessment from 2014, whether it be mental health, whether it be access to health care, transportation, et cetera.
So the reallocation didn't distort the community assessment of needs vision, and it didn't leave holes in what you had planned on, what you would hope to do.
Correct. I would say that I don't know if I'd go so far as to say that there weren't any holes. I would say even at the previous level of funding, when our campaigns were at $3.5 to $4 million, I would say there were still needs that probably weren't able to be funded that were pointed out in the community needs assessment. But as far as the changes that came about because of last year's fundraising campaign, it didn't create a situation where it distorted those needs that were highlighted from the community needs assessment. To your point, too, I think probably sometime in the next year or two, it's going to be important to provide a refresh or an update to that. Most communities try to do needs assessments every 3 to 6 years, give or take. And I think the gap between community needs assessments here in this community was around 2001 to 2014. So it was a much longer gap the last time. So that's definitely something that's on our radar because we want to identify, to your point, are there any gaps? Are there any new needs that are popping up that weren't you know, exactly visible or deemed critical back in 2014-15 kind of time frame.
Especially given the radically changed landscape and delivery of state-supported services.
Correct, yeah. You know, that is one of the big changes since the last time you and I had a conversation, is that there is at least some certainty. It's not necessarily the news that agencies would have wanted to hear, per se, and there's still some uncertainty about what services they provided in the past and whether or not those will be reimbursed. But at least there's a spending plan and there's a tax increase that they know will help to provide revenue for that spending plan. And I think all of that combined has helped somewhat, but I think that it's still, it is different than it was just a few years ago. And I think there is more, there's more chaos, if you will, and I think for some agencies, there's also some more uncertainty moving forward of how long they can sustain, because the funding levels, both from the state, from local philanthropy, et cetera, has altered dramatically in the last few years. And I think a lot of them during the past 2 years of the budget crisis burned up a lot of reserves and lines of credit, et cetera.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with David Taylor, the CEO of the United Way of McLean County. Back in the spring, we had dealt in depth with the change in philanthropic patterns and some businesses in town choosing not to run a consolidated campaign anymore, but allowing their employees to have a menu of options on allocating their charitable dollars, and how that eroded some of the traditional support that the United Way had. And at the time, you were studying ways to address that. Mm-hmm. You now have a vision to go forward. Lay that out for us, would you?
Sure. So one of the things that we've been working on over the last year is creating a new strategic plan. And at a high level, the three priorities that we've identified are making it personal, local, and accessible, convening and coordinating resources, and ultimately the third one, attracting, educating, and retaining donors. Those are essentially, I'm simplifying a little bit, but that at its core is what we're trying to do. And you know, right now the landscape has shifted fairly dramatically in how philanthropy is done. Look at some of the tech giants out in Silicon Valley, out in the Northwest with Amazon. They have frequently, and they've kind of really started that pattern of employee choice, employee satisfaction, and determining how different things are done in the workplace, up to and including philanthropy and how philanthropy dollars are spent, how they're matched by the company, et cetera. We've seen two local examples of that already here. State Farm Insurance has moved to an employee matching gift program. We know with that program that St. Jude and Wounded Warrior are among the two top charities of choice among the employees, and that definitely has an impact because both of those are great organizations that do great work. We know that their impact locally here may not be as significant as some organization like the Baby Fold or Project Oz or one of those other local organizations working on some local needs. Cargill also has gone to a national program similar to that, where they do an employee matching gift program that's not a specific United Way campaign. And I think that this is a trend that's not going away. This is not something that's just isolated among a few organizations. I think nationally, this is more the trend and the way the winds and the landscape is shifting. And we have to really be cognizant of that and starting to figure out how we're going to connect with donors outside of the workplace. And I think that's one of the key drivers behind that first priority, if you will, within the strategic plan, is making it personal, local, and accessible. We've got a lot of local needs here that I think are needing to be met, that there are gaps in, that we want to try to address. Take, for example, there's last year that we know about, and this is just what we know about, there were 82 women between the ages of 18 to 22 that were pregnant and either ended up running away from home or being kicked out of the house as a result. Of those, 71 were turned away from services, not because they didn't qualify, but because there wasn't space, there weren't enough resources. And that's a pretty significant issue, and that's not something that can be outsourced, if you will, to another community to handle that. That's something that we have to be able to address. And
how do you make that story known and other stories like it then?
Well, and that's what we're starting to do, is starting to craft those personal stories, if you will, to start to create that I guess, sense of urgency, if you will, that there are problems here that people may not be aware of. And we're trying to work with our agency partners and others to highlight some of that. Take that example that I just gave you. It's not a single agency that can resolve that issue. And so, for example, Project Oz has the maternity group home that served those 11. So of those 82, there were 11 that were able to be served. That's all they had space for. But they're not the only ones that help with that issue. Babyfold provides prenatal counseling and care as far as how the young mothers should be preparing for their babies and for care afterwards through a program called Healthy Start. You've got the Center for Human Services that provides counseling and other supports because it's traumatic and probably stressful to be homeless, let alone to be under 22 and pregnant and homeless. And so it's really kind of, there's this continuum of care, if you will. There's this holistic kind of approach and really a good coordination, I think, among agencies that a lot of people don't recognize on the surface. It's that hidden social infrastructure that we talked about the last time I was here. And so we're working to start educating. As we're getting into our traditional campaign season here, we've got workplace campaigns kicking off this month, next month. We're telling that story. That's one of the ones that we're highlighting to let people know there are needs in this area that are critical to be addressed. And hey, guess what? For small incremental kind of changes, we can work harder to address those. Like say, for example, if an existing donor increased their donation $15 a month, or if a new donor came in giving $15 a month, that starts to get us to that point where we can make sure those other 71 aren't without those supports.
In this fragmented eyeball world, though, where people pay attention to many different information sources rather than a traditional few, how do you reach the ones who are not part of that traditional campaign that you just mentioned?
That's a great question. And that's really part of what we're trying to accomplish, too, through our strategic plan. We were started as community chess. Like if you've ever played Monopoly and you land on the community chess space, that's the predecessor. That's the forerunner to United Way. And when that started, it was a business-to-consumer kind of a connection, a B2C. So instead of United Way coming to WGLT, it would be David Taylor as either a staff member or volunteer coming to Charlie Schlenker and saying, we'd like your support in helping these particular needs in the community. Over time, you know, United Way became very successful, and through payroll deduction post-World War II, it became more of a business-to-business, a B2B kind of connection to where now no longer was our relationship with Charlie as the individual, it was with the organization that he worked for. And over time, then that meant that we maybe lost control of the message, lost control of the information, and lost control of the access. And so we're working hard to reestablish those individual connections through a variety of means, including digital marketing strategies, social media, just traditional media such as this. We're going through different avenues to figure out how we can meet the donor where it's most convenient for them. That used to be the workplace. But now we know at organizations like State Farm, Cargill, and some others, as they move to more of the employee matching gift kind of mindset, we have to figure out how to connect with those donors in other places as well.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. David Taylor is the guest today. He's the CEO of the United Way of McLean County. One of the concerns is that the demographic shifts in the nation are, for instance, the millennials who have been reputed to value different things than their predecessor generations, are donating more towards cause-based philanthropy than community-based philanthropy. Are you still seeing that? Is there more information out there than there was in the spring about that particular suspected trend?
I would say that's definitely still a trend, and that's part of why we're looking at the programs that are serving those needs in the community, and we're pulling out those narratives to be able to share with people, just like we talked about with those women that are, you know, 18 to 22 and find themselves homeless and pregnant. So we're trying to find those narratives because I think that's something very concrete. It's a need or a cause that people can recognize that it's certainly not acceptable probably in any community, but I think in Bloomington Normal in McLean County, where we pride ourselves on quality of life and great place to raise a family, knowing that there are at least 71, and again, I'll go back to those are the ones we know about that qualified for services and couldn't get them, you know, that creates a local need and a cause I think that people can get behind. And that's just one example. And we're working through that right now, Charlie, to create those other examples, because I think people want to know how would the money be used? Not just let's give to United Way because they do good work, but we have to be accountable for what we do and demonstrate here's what we're fighting for. Here's what we're fighting to solve. Here's what we're trying to do for the better, for the good of the community and for the clients that are being served.
Is that trend among millennials reversible? We're starting to see housing purchases change as the oldest millennials get children and married and family, and they're buying the houses and they're buying the SUVs or minivans. So is the philanthropy piece of that going to change as well?
You know, I would say that's a possibility. I think that we also have to look at it as how much information now is available relative to before. Part of the reason workplace campaigns were so successful is before 2005, really, you didn't have smartphones, the vast internet that had information for people available at their fingertips. You were educated through those speakers coming to your workplace to tell you about what's going on in the community. Now people are able to find it. So I think information has been a disruptor in a good way, and the technology in a good way, because it helps people be more educated and informed about what's going on around them. But it's still going to be about whether or not they feel like it's important to them and whether or not they feel like there's something that they can do that would create a positive change in it. So I think that's part of the key challenge to us, is how do we educate, attract, and retain donors? And that's, to your point, I think those preferences for them can change, but we also have to be able to tell the story and help them understand why what they can do, whether it's $15 a month or $1,500 per year, why that can make a big difference in their communities.
Having had such a significant difference in donations between this last campaign and the prior campaign, the previous campaign, what are you expecting this year as you gear up again?
You know, I would say that our expectation is around the same amount that we saw last year. I would expect us to be somewhere between 1.5 and 2 million. We're at 1.8, and it's still creeping up a little bit, because one of the positive impacts of an employee matching gift kind of program like State Farm is running, for example, is that whereas before there was a 1 week, 2 week, 1 month period during which an employee could make a commitment to a particular organization or a United Way pledge, now they can do it year round. And so that's one of the things that we're trying to do to increase the probabilities that we will have a stronger campaign than we had in this most recent year. We've started doing some very aggressive digital marketing as well as social media to try and create that push. We're kind of drilling down to a concept that we're calling 180 United. And if you visit 180united.org, you can learn a little bit more about what's going on there. And kind of the premise behind that, for example, Charlie, is, you know, in life, a 180 typically signifies some change in direction. You know, you say, oh, that person did a 180. And what we're trying to highlight are positive 180s. But we're also trying to get at the fact that you don't have to give large amounts of money to make a meaningful difference. So we saw a 1.7 million drop in the revenue year over year. If in the next 3 years we can get 5,000 donors to contribute just $15 per month, we would make up more than half of that, because that equals $15 a month equals 180. And so we're trying to, you talk about the immediacy, we're trying to get at that Netflix style subscription, if you will, to philanthropy, where, hey, for a small bit each month, you can make an investment in your community that's going to have a big impact. And what we're trying to do through that that website is to highlight positive 180s that are going on in the community and how people can get connected with that.
You know, each new wrinkle in philanthropy can draw attention and can attract some loyalty from civic-minded people, community-minded people, generous people. But whether it's this sort of subscription model or whether it's a call-in or whether it's a business campaign, each method of reaching people and attracting their contribution to good things only lasts so long.
Correct.
How long is the life cycle for this sort of sustaining subscription going to be, do you think?
And that's why we're looking at smaller incremental donations that are on a debit or credit card that would just be like people that sign up for Amazon Prime or Netflix or something like that. That I think one of the key challenges these days, too, is you talked a little bit about millennials buying houses, SUVs. I think that both the millennials and Generation X, I guess you would call it, are much more mobile, not just geographically, but also within workplaces. When you think of the baby boomers and that generation, they would go to work at one particular company, and they would very likely they were going to stay there for 30 years or more. I think now you're seeing more movement between workplaces without them ever leaving Bloomington Normal or McLean County, for example. And as a result, when each time they move, given our current model, or at least the traditional model of workplace campaigns, we may lose that connection. And so by trying to, one, encourage repeated small donations that's on their debit or credit card, and number two, you know, doing it outside of the workplace, we're hoping to maintain those connections for a longer period of time and make it in a way where it's kind of like a savings program or a 401k, where it's small incremental things, but you forget about it. But over time, it adds up to quite a bit of an impact.
David Taylor is the CEO of the United Way of McLean County. He spoke with Charlie Schlenker here on WGLT Normal. Find this interview and the rest of today's show thanks to Ryan Denham at WGLT.org. That's also where you can find the full Sound Ideas podcast. We're also curious about what you think. Get in touch using email. The address is news@WGLT.org. You can also post at facebook.com/WGLTFM or tweet about the show. Use the hashtag Sound Ideas. I'm at Mike McCurdy. We're all at WGLT News. This is 89.1 FM GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.